Welcome to Raising Playful Tots. Raising Playful Tots is a weekly podcast about mums making the most of early years playtime. I'm your host, Melissa. Welcome to the play space. It's here that we focus on play that we want to see and experience in our homes. We cover play-related topics to inspire, teach, challenge, and lead us to have a great time with these kids of ours. You have children under 5 years old? This is the podcast for you. Introduce a new play idea. Welcome to another episode of Raising Playful Tots. Glad you could stop by today. If you're new to the show, welcome. And hi to the regular playmates. Plenty of room in the cardboard box pirate ship here. Bring your wooden spoon. Last week's show, I shared an interview with Ashley Merriman, author of Nurture Shock, about the impact of praise in our child's play. So if you missed that one, pop on over to the blog where you can listen to that show and find the archive of all the shows at www.raisingplayfultots.com/shows. This week's show is with Amanda Morgan, specialist in child development and early education, a mum who puts it all into practice and a blogger at notjustcute.com. She's here today to answer a listener question from Amber, who's from Detroit, all about how to teach sharing to our under 5 year old children. So I hope you'll stick around. If you enjoyed the show, please consider pinning us on Pinterest or sharing with your friends. Thanks. I'll be right back after this short break.
Healthy Fresh Art Mart.
This week, enjoy Art Smart products your family will eat up. One serving of Van Gogurt contains the live and active culture your kids need. Buy one, get higher test scores free. And nothing satisfies a child's craving for self-expression like Tchaikovsky's Nutcrackers, now with more music and dance in every bite. Try original flavor or new Sugar Plum Fairy. Feed your kids the arts. Visit AmericansForTheArts.org to learn how. The arts. Ask for more.
Today I'm talking to Amanda Morgan, freelance writer, full-time mum to three busy boys with a fourth boy on the way, and a part-time trainer and consultant for a non-profit children's organisation. She's the author of two ebooks, and she also writes at Not Just Cute, a blog focused on intentional whole child development. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Melissa.
No matter where you go, our children have to learn how to share. Share their toys, share their space, share their parents when they have more siblings, share other children's toys. In your capacity as an early childhood educator and trainer, you come across probably many families in this particular stage. Some with stressed children and stressed families and stressed behaviors. How can you teach your child to share?
Well, I think you touched on one of the most important parts there, and that's understanding that it's a learned behavior. You know, we never expect our children to just suddenly gain academic skills like reading, for example, because they reach a certain age, but somehow we start to think, well, she's three, she should be able to share by now. But understanding that it's a learned behavior and they need that practice. So a few of the things that I point out with people is just to recognize, I'm really big on recognizing where behavior comes from before we try to do anything about it. We have to understand kind of the cause and the root. And so I think we first have to understand that children see things from their own perspective. So I think it's so funny when we talk about sharing, most kids think that means share with me. In fact, I was watching a behavior video just the other day, and it's two kids wrestling over this toy, and one of them just shouts, "He won't share with me!" And they each see this injustice, because to them, sharing means give me what I want.
Yes.
And so we have to first understand that that's how they see it, that if they're seeing it that way, then that's the first problem, that they're seeing sharing means give me what I want. But helping them to understand turn-taking and waiting for a turn is a big part of sharing as well. So seeing first that egocentric perspective that they'll have and recognizing that it's a learned skill. But I think a big part that helps me and has helped some people that I've been associated with is understanding the concept of power for young children, especially as they emerge in the past the toddler and into the preschool years. They're very much driven by this autonomy and having this self-control and having power and being able to act. And so if we approach sharing as a loss of power, that it's something they have to give up and we're kind of forcing them into, it's always a battle. But if we help empower them through the sharing process, it tends to be more successful. So if we give them those choices and let them know, you know, would you like to have a turn now? Would you like to give her a turn later? Giving them some choices in when and what they share usually helps out. And then giving them practice and helping them to have opportunities to share when it's not so threatening. So sharing neutral items. So if you jump right in asking them to share their favorite things, that's never going to go over very well. But if you bring in a neutral item, say some treats that you got at the store, and give your child the opportunity to share them by passing them out with guests that may come over, friends they may have over, that gives them the opportunity to share and see that positive social impact without really losing something that they owned themselves.
Right.
So I think that's an important part, giving them that neutral opportunity. And then also recognizing that they don't always have to share. In my opinion, I don't think we as adults are expected to share everything either.
No.
So I think it's fair to recognize that, you know, if you're having a play date and kids are coming over, that there are certain items we should maybe put away beforehand, things that are hard to share or, things that are easily broken that maybe need to be put away. I guess I try to explain to my kids it's okay not to share everything, but if you have something you don't want to share, then it's more polite to put it away and not have it in front of your friends. Because just as it's natural for them not to want to share some things, it's also natural for other children seeing it to want to have a turn with it.
Yes.
So I think it's teaching some of that as well.
I think maybe if we are proactive and we see that our children really like something, and if they're not at that stage to be able to say it, I know my boys when they were much younger weren't very good at expressing what they mm-hmm. felt, other than tugging at it, pulling at it, and then wailing. So the language just wasn't developed well enough for them to be able to do that. But I knew that it might be a problem. So, you know, things would just kind of disappear if friends were going to come around.
Right.
So they would look for it and I'd be like, oh, I don't know, maybe it's got washed or something. But it just kind of helped, I thought.
Yeah, I definitely think it's something to be proactive about. And that, like you said, depending on the child's age and language ability, to that kind of determines their role in that. But it's just, you can see it coming a mile away sometimes. And so you just remove that temptation in some situations and provide opportunities where it is easier. So they're, like I said, the neutral items, or making sure you have enough of everything to be able to share adequately. And it's, you know, you have enough supplies for everybody to have something to play with. Those kinds of proactive steps are big. And I think you hit on as well with the language skills. That's really a big part of social skills in general. And so we guide our children through the actions of sharing, but I think it's just important to guide them through the language of sharing. And so even with the very young children, with toddlers, to kind of parallel talk or sports cast as they're playing and talking about, you'd like a turn with that. How would, as you can see them playing, they're not saying anything, but you can see, oh, you know, John's playing with that ball. It looks like you would like a turn. We need to ask John for a turn. And if your child can't, you know, say what you're saying, you can talk for them and talk them through those social skills to give them a social script. And I've had a lot of success with preschoolers that can do their own talking, just teaching them, can I have a turn when you're done, please? It's one of those social scripts that's just been almost magical for me to watch children use, because, you know, in 1 minute they're pulling and tugging and fighting over it. And as soon as you introduce that script, I just think it includes all those components. So they're not just saying, can I have a turn, which can be threatening, saying, give it to me now.
Yes.
But saying, can I have a turn when you're done, is easier for both of them, because it communicates to the player that you can finish first, and it communicates to the one that's asking, you know, you don't get it immediately, but when she's done, she'll be giving it to you. And it's so funny to watch how quickly, you know, these children that are playing tug of war, suddenly the player is done in 30 seconds because it's their own choice. It goes back to that power thing. If you let them have a little power and control in when they get to give it up, then it goes so much more smoothly than when we try to intervene too much and interject ourselves too much into that social situation.
So would you say then, Amanda, that it's important to use that specific language quite a few times, that there's not an expectation that you say it, that type of phrase, and that they will immediately be able to use it? Would you repeat it quite often in your play over a period of time?
Oh, absolutely. I think it's the same as with any language skills. You know, our children need to hear it several times before they learn a word, and especially with social scripts, they need to hear it and also use it before they really own it. And that's part of why I'm a big fan of, I call them scripts, because I feel like it's something where we use the same words as best we can and as frequently as we can. And then once the children begin to own it, then they begin to use variations and they'll word it differently. But I, especially with things like that one, I'll teach it to them maybe in a very neutral situation with puppets or different things with my own children, or if I'm working with a classroom, but to introduce it. But then it's interesting when they get in the play and it becomes a heated moment, they aren't going to, most children won't think of it right off that they, I remember what I'm supposed to say. But as soon as you remind them, then they switch right into it because it's familiar, because they've heard it before. We've laid the groundwork, but you're right. They have to hear it and use it several times before they really own it and can go to it as their own personal tool.
We've been talking briefly about what it's like when children come to our house or we go to somebody else's house and we might have a battle with some of the toys. I know that this is a major area of contention with many of our listeners. Just that whole thing of when you go to somebody else's house, they have different rules than you have at your house. Or maybe you go to like a play group or a church group and, you know, there's now a communal toys, but of course children have their favorites and they pick up some toy and they're walking around with it and they want to have it all the time. It's kind of a minefield, you know, dealing with, you know, because you feel bad as the adults feel bad about it, then you feel bad about what your kids are doing, and then you get mad at what the other kids are doing. You know, how do you deal with that whole situation of other children and your way that you share and the way that they share?
Yes. Well, I think if it's a play group, something that's fairly consistent, it would be helpful as the adults to sit down and lay out some ground rules so that everybody can be on the same page. Because it introduces a whole new layer when you also have not just adults that have to work out their social differences, but parents, which can be a whole much higher level of emotion.
Yes.
So I would suggest, especially if it's a consistent group, to sit down and lay out, you know, what are our expectations? What can we do to help support those expectations? And so that we can all be on the same page and be introducing some of these same scripts and these same expectations. It'll be more helpful for the adults, so you're not just fumbling around in the dark together. But also so that you can be consistent with the children as well, so that they get a clear message. Because I think those groups are so, the purpose is it's a social purpose. We want to give them that exposure and we want to give them that practice. And I think if we can be on the same page with people, then it's better for those children, because they're going to have an experience that's consistent, not only from time to time, but also consistent with our intentions, what we want them to learn and the process we want to learn. And that can be tricky, because we come with different perspectives. There's some people that are more, I guess, more adult driven, and others that are more child centered. And so you kind of have to work out those differences. I'd say aside from that, that's where it's maybe easier, where you do have a planned and consistent group and you can sit down and lay out those ground rules. And when you don't, if it's one of those drop-in inconsistent groupings, I would say, you know, really, I'd say stick to what you're comfortable with and don't change how you parent your child, and use gentle guiding language. And in the interactions that your child has with other children, try to use that same gentle guiding language that you use. And I think when you set that example, I guess I try when I'm in those types of situations where I can tell I have a difference of philosophy from other adults, I try not just to do my part in modeling and encouraging the children, but having kind of a second mindset that I'm trying to model for the other adults as well, and hoping that they might see how I'm doing it. And
yes.
if you know, that they might do the same. So I think getting down on the floor with the children and helping out with those situations and guiding them through some of that social coaching can hopefully help set a precedence. I would hope, but it's a difficult situation. You're right. It is a minefield. I think you aptly named that.
Well, I know that it can be one of the biggest causes of, you know, people staying inside their house and not having friends around or even not going to play groups. And you can become isolated because you think either you have the crazy child that won't share anything and then, you know, all the violence that comes with that sometimes.
Right.
Or you think that your child has been wronged because some other child came and took their things and you feel, well, I'm never going back to that place. It can be, you know, often when I speak to other mothers and that aren't now going to play groups or don't have children around to their homes, sharing is one of the big things that come up with that. And we can all feel guilty about that, I guess, but having this script, like you said, and really having a purpose about and an intention when you go to these places and when people come over, it's all about practice, it sounds like.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think if we go into those situations and our mindset is we're just trying to create the most fun experience for our child, well, they can do that anywhere by themselves, home alone, and it kind of robs them of that social practice. And so if we go in with the mindset that we're here for them to learn, and with learning comes some failures and some struggles and hopefully a lot of successes, it makes it a little bit easier, because you're right, we do judge ourselves harshly and sometimes judge others, and we hate to be in that position where we feel like we have the hard child or we must not be a good parent. But just recognizing that part of learning means having that struggle, that we learn through struggle and conflict. And so we want to be able to minimize it and make it healthy conflict, but to take it all away kind of robs them of that practice and that experience as well.
Amanda, you said in an interview with the Simple Kids editor, Cara Fleck, that positive guidance is based on a belief that young children often misbehave, not because they're bad, but because they haven't yet learned social complexities or built adequate impulse control. And that was like, wow, a really powerful statement, that it wasn't that the children were deliberately not doing, that they don't know how because I, as a parent, have to teach them. So why is sharing such a struggle?
You know, I think it kind of goes against our human nature to a degree. Eventually it makes sense to us because we see how it builds relationships and it makes other people happy. But for young children, that's not something they generally see immediately. So I think that's a big part of the struggle. They want to keep that power. They want to keep that ownership. And because they're egocentric and they see it primarily, not that they can't see another person's perspective, and especially with experience and time, but their first impulse is to take care of themselves and to see things when I'm happy, everybody's happy. And so I need to be happy. And so they're kind of trying to fill that need as a natural developmental response. But it's also, they have to, like the quote that you just mentioned, they have to build that understanding and that experience. And a part of that comes from development and time and maturation, and a lot of it comes from experience, and a lot of it comes from teaching and being guided. And so it's not something that they learn right away, just like with teaching them to tie their shoes or teaching them to read. We don't sit down for 5 minutes and talk about it and it's over with. It takes a long time to practice and struggle and build the skills necessary to make it successful.
So there's going to be lots of play dates and lots of opportunities for...
And I think it's so funny because I often have to remind myself as a parent, I talk to people sometimes, I have this consultation and child development quote unquote expert side of my brain, and then there's my parenting brain, and so I see it from both sides as a parent. There are days and I'm just thinking, what am I doing wrong? I can't get this. What is going on? And that the developmental side of my brain says it's practice and it's experience and it takes time, and it's, so I know it's hard as a parent to sit back and say, well, we didn't get it today, but there's always tomorrow. But that, as hard as it is to see that as a parent, it is a part of growing up and of childhood. And it's development, because it's, you know, just the whole word implies a process, not an instant. And so I totally understand how it can be overwhelming and frustrating, and you can feel such personal pressure, but there's, I think there's also some comfort in recognizing that when children react emotionally and when they do have struggle and conflict, it's reassuring to me to recognize that that is part of the process. That's not necessarily a reflection on my parenting skills. It just reflects the process of learning and growing from struggle and failure, and that's part of the learning process. That's part of development. And like I said, we want to keep it to a healthy level, and we want to encourage and help them to be successful. But recognizing that if you save your child from every conflict and every disappointment and every tantrum and every struggle, they don't have the opportunity to really grow and develop and thrive as they should. So I can see it from both sides. I can see how overwhelming and frustrating it can be, but also the comfort that comes from understanding the process as well.
Yeah. Yeah. Totally. I mean, I witnessed my two boys just the other day doing something similar. Just the negotiation that was happening with the sharing, and that they were trying to work out what to do. It just made me smile, because it was it was just not going to work the way that they both were doing it. But just watching them.
But it's so great to see them own it and try it, and that's such a great part of the process. It's so I love it when they do try. And there are times that I watch and think, there is no way that that's going to work, but they yes. make it work sometimes. Yes. Because it was theirs, and if any adult had come in and said, here's how we're gonna fix it, it probably wouldn't have worked. But sometimes when the kids decide that's how they fix it, because they're on board and they own it, it works out. And I love seeing them get involved in the problem solving process. That's such a great moment.
I know. Sometimes I think, I wish I could do it that way.
Exactly.
You know, they fly in the face of, they get an emphatic no. You can tell that it's like not going to happen. And then they kind of do all the, oh, please. Or they go for a, you know, I'll switch you this. And they're like, okay.
Yeah.
And I'm like, that would never happen in real life with
yeah,
me.
If you walked in and tried to switch, they would never trade for that.
Exactly. Today I'm talking to Amanda Morgan from Not Just Cute. You can read her blog or have your questions answered about early childhood development by visiting her site, notjustcute.com. Amanda, you've written a book on positive guidance, which I really recommend. For those that are not familiar with your work, can you share a bit about it?
Sure. I as you mentioned earlier, I do some consulting work with a nonprofit children's organization. And what I do is I go into some of these early childhood centers and we talking about best practice and different things. And a lot of the classes that I've taught have dealt with positive guidance. And as I would teach these classes, I tend to process things by writing. And so I would often teach them and a great conversation would come up, or I'd be processing, now here's how we do it in the classroom. How do I apply that now to what I'm dealing with my own children as a parent? And I just really believe in, you know, truth is truth. And so if it works in this setting, how do I apply that to a parenting setting? Am I really living it on both ends? And so I was writing a lot about it on my blogs, just implementing positive guidance from this clinical sense that I've been teaching it into a personal sense as a parent. And I was really struck by the response that I was getting from the readers. And at the same time, as I was doing some of this consulting work, I had one meeting in particular where I was meeting with the director and some parents of a child who had been struggling, and we were talking about different ways to address his behavior. And I was really struck when these parents said they were interested in learning more, but they just didn't know where to go, that they needed more resources, and they were interested and willing, but they didn't know where to find it. And it just struck me that as professionals, as a teacher, I always knew where I could get these resources, these professional development resources, but as a parent, it might be harder to come across those. So it was kind of this collision of worlds for me. So I started taking some of this writing and adding more to it, and created this ebook that basically takes the positive guidance tools that I'd been teaching and using as a teacher and teaching to teachers and other people in early childhood settings, taking those tools that professionals are quite familiar with and applying it to a parenting setting so that parents could implement it in their own home. And my hope was that not only would it help parents to understand positive guidance and the tools of positive guidance and how to implement it in their own homes, but also help create that link between the settings of preschools or childcare centers and homes, and giving them that common language, that common philosophy of positive guidance, because it's quite common for professionals in the early childhood field, but maybe something that parents aren't quite as familiar with. And so I'm hoping that it kind of bridges that gap a little bit.
Well, I think it does, because we come with our own default settings that we have, you know, our ideas of what we want to do as parents, and the tapes that we play in our mind about how we were parented.
Right.
And sometimes they're not so good. Once you start speaking them and they come out of your mouth, you're a bit like, oh, that's not going to work. And wow, I just sounded like my mum or my whoever. And so it's really good when you can actually look at evidence based on good research that really expresses some things that you're struggling with. And I found that within your book, that it really gave you good, firm ideas about how you can try things with your children.
Oh, thank you. And I hoped to give tools that would help, like you said, help with those specific situations, but also leave it open enough for some variation for parents that, you know, because we do all come with different scripts, and there's some scripts we want to get rid of, but there's some that we feel very strongly about. And so I feel like they're tools that can be implemented within a spectrum of positive parenting, that we don't all have to do it exactly the same way. You know, sometimes I'll give, it might sound like this, and I'll kind of give a way that it could sound just to give people an idea of how to implement it. But I don't want people to walk around trying to sound like robots.
Yes. You know,
I feel like they're tools that can be applied in so many different ways to fit different situations and different philosophies within that spectrum. So I'm hopeful that it can help parents be the best parents that they want to be, and not just feel guilty about what somebody else thinks they should be doing, but hopefully just to better what they're already doing and get closer to what they're already striving for.
Let's get to know you a little better now.
Okay.
What are two actions that you've taken in the last 2 years that you feel have had a positive effect on your life?
One is pretty easy. I think it's been within the last 2 years that I've started writing the blog, and started, it was about 2 years ago that I began doing the consulting work that I've been doing, and it really has changed the way that I look at things. And I've always been somebody that processes things. It's almost like I have a running narrative in my head as I work things out. And so it's been a nice outlet to take what I'm thinking and write it down. And, it's had a great effect on me, and to be able to take this conversation in my head and share it with so many wonderful people and get their perspectives on things, and to think from different angles, and to think more deeply about these things that really intrigue me and things that I get passionate about. So that's an easy answer, out of those two. Let's see, something different. I always want to say running, but I've been doing that for a long time. It just goes up and down over the years. You know, so somewhere in the 2 years, I ran I ran a half marathon with my sister. That was new.
Ooh.
My sister, who was never going to be a runner and wasn't interested in, so I think seeing her, that was, within the last year, she completed her first half marathon. We ran the same half marathon. And so I felt like that was a great moment for me to see her realize that she could do that, and she does it well, and she enjoys it, and she's probably running more miles than I am right now. And so it was a great thing for me to take, again, something that I'm passionate about, and see somebody else kind of dip their toes in the water and then realize that, hey, they're kind of passionate about it too.
That's so nice. You were part of that. Yeah, that's really cool. What were you doing 12 years ago?
Oh my, I think 12 years ago, you know, like we said, it's hard to remember life before you had kids. What did I do before?
Exactly.
I want to say that 12 years ago, I was probably doing my student teaching. I student taught kindergarten and sixth grade. So it was this great
spread,
and I loved it. Most people, I would tell them that's what I was doing, and they thought someone had made a mistake. Why would they? I had a dual major. It was early childhood and elementary education, and they put me on the exact opposite ends of that spectrum. But I loved that opportunity to see so many differences and also so many similarities.
Okay.
It was a great experience. So yeah, I was living the single college life, finishing up my schooling and getting ready for graduate school.
Very nice, very nice. I really can't imagine that, because I trained in the elementary teaching area too, and I can't imagine doing the early childhood at the same time. It just seemed like, wow, they have completely different ends.
They were very different. I completed one and then the other. I can't remember if I think it was a semester. So half the semester was in one and half was the other.
Okay.
So they weren't exactly simultaneously,
yes.
But.
Yes, you could switch.
But they were right after each other. So they were within the same time period. It was great. You know, I enjoyed them both and they were very different, but they were, it's always fun for me to see those salient, qualities to education or in anything. I love seeing those truths that remain constant over change. I'm just kind of a nerd that way. I'm analyzing things all the time.
It's nice when there's a bunch of children all together and you can see it all in action. Yeah, absolutely. So what's your favorite play activity in the Morgan household right now?
Oh, you know, with a big bunch of boys and the ages that they're in right now, I would say Legos are one of the most popular things, or anything construction. My boys are so much into that creation, you know, so all the Legos and Bionicles and things that I don't even know what they're called. All the time. Building things and creating new things, and I'm just trying to keep up most of the time. And then just dramatic play, though they would never call it that. But there's always a story that they're creating, and they're, you know, making characters and running around and acting things out. And so I would say those are probably the top two. I would say 90% of their play is probably in one of those two areas. They're either building something or they're acting out and creating these stories and the props and the forts to go along with them.
Brilliant. Today I've been talking to Amanda Morgan, freelance writer, full-time mom, part-time trainer and consultant for a non-profit children's organization. She's the author of two ebooks, Parenting with Positive Guidance and Creativity Matters, which is currently free. She also writes at Not Just Cute, a blog focused on intentional whole child development. Thanks for being on the show, Amanda.
Thank you.
I'll be right back after this short break.
Hello, this is Mark Hamilton from JustAskBaby.com on Raising Playful Tots.
Welcome back to the show. Wasn't Amanda fantastic? Common sense and examples to keep us on our way. This month of February has been a focus on personal and social development. We've had shows on praise and sharing, plus a review of books to add to your library to start and continue the conversation about social topics and books for children at that. Over on the play-activities blog, I've been busy writing about tackling emotions, both our emotions and their emotions, creating a play scenario to lead to a discussion on an issue as well. A lot of the problems that we have around raising playful tots seem to have roots in our behaviour as parents and carers and their reaction to it. How we set up our home and how they react to it. Whether we provide varied and ample opportunities or not so much. It's not easy. There isn't a one way to raise a playful tot. And here, on Raising Playful Tots, we like to discuss lots of different ways that people can tackle this. Your task is to listen and to try, because you just never know. It might work for your family better than you anticipate. But you know what? You won't know until you try. So I'm challenging you today to not just listen to the shows, but to listen and do something different this week. Maybe it was a show on the family mission statement that really got you thinking. Go get the book, go to the library, go to the bookshop, check the book out and see if you can completely change the way that you do things. Or maybe it is that you've decided you just want to be a bit more unstructured and you've decided, okay, we're just going to go ahead and do it. Well, plan for it. Sit down with your diary and find a way that you can get this done. One final book in this series of personal, social and emotional growth that we have been talking about this month I want to share with you is one written by today's guest, Amanda Morgan. I've been a big fan of Amanda's clear and simple ideas for quite a while. Her posts over at notjustcute.com will have you nodding and get you on the road to intentional playfulness. I've reviewed her popular book, Parenting with Positive Guidance. If you've enjoyed this interview today, then you'll not want to lose out on the nuggets that she shares in her ebook. To hear more about the ebook and see if this is something that you want, then you need to go over to my blog and read the review. You can find that at play-activities.com/blog/positive-guidance. That's playactivities.com/blog/positive-guidance. Thanks for listening to the show today, and I hope you liked what you heard. You've been listening to Raising Playful Tots, show number 87. Come over and play next week. Until then, find time for some unplugged play. Join with me each week as we share, learn, and laugh together about making the most of early childhood playtime. Goodbye!